from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is a special edition of On Point before a live audience at the Paramount Theater in Boston. To our guests in the hall and listeners around the country, welcome to On Point Live. We love taking On Point out to our listeners. We broadcast from all over Nashville, New Orleans, LA Thousand Oaks, Charlotte, Denver, even Shanghai. Right now, we're in Boston, and we're talking with best-selling author, feminist thinker, and tough love advice giver, Cheryl Strayed, famed for her advice in Dear Sugar, her 1,100-mile hike of self-discovery in Wild, her courage, her radical empathy. This hour, On Point, Cheryl Strayed. We're recording this show before a live audience at the beautiful Paramount Theater in downtown Boston. We've invited questions from our audience here and across the country online, on Facebook, on Twitter. We are loaded for bear, so let's go. Joining me now on stage is Cheryl Strayed, author of the New York Times best-selling book, Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail, which was turned into an Oscar-nominated movie last year starring Reese Witherspoon. She's one of the two voices behind the popular podcast Dear Sugar Radio from WBUR Boston and wrote the Dear Sugar advice column for the literary website The Rumpus. She's also author of the book Tiny Beautiful Things, Advice on Love and Life from Dear Sugar. She's been called a secular pilgrim, a secular priest, and the modern-day spokeswoman for self-reliance on and off the trail. Cheryl Strayed, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thanks so much. It's lovely to be here.
It's great to have you. It is wonderful to have you. So I heard on Morning Edition that the Pacific Crest Trail is just overrun with people ever since you made it so famous. Do they curse you for that out there, or thank you for all the attention you brought?
I think it's a little bit of both. Most people who care about the trail are really grateful that so many people know about it. When I first was going around the country talking about Wild, I would ask audiences, how many of you first heard of the PCT when you read Wild? And most people would raise their hands. And so I love it that the book did bring so much awareness. I think there's hardly anything better than a book inspiring people to go take a walk. So that just thrills me to no end.
Are you still on the trail? Is it the trail that never ends? People never stop talking about it to you, I'm sure. You did it when you were 26. You
right.
wrote about it well after that, and then the movie after that, and here we are well after it again. What about for you? Is the trail, that hike, that whole story, blessing, curse, both?
It's a blessing. I didn't know what a blessing it would turn out to be. I started 20 years ago hiking that trail.
Yeah.
This summer is the 20th anniversary of my hike.
Hey,
yay! And you know, when I was taking that hike, I had absolutely no idea that anyone would ever know about it. I was a writer then. I knew that everything that happens in my life might end up in my book someday, but I wasn't thinking that I would write a book. And of course, when I was writing Wild, I had no idea that so many people would read it.
And so many people did read it. They must come to you every time you step out in the street with their stories and your story in mind.
It's really beautiful. I mean, that's been the most interesting thing, as I think we often assume that that conversation would be about me and my book. But usually when people approach me, what they tell me about is their own lives, their own journeys, the adventures they took or didn't take, and also that layer, that their grief, because of course I write a lot about my mother's death in the book.
Catherine Schultz wrote about it very beautifully in Vulture.com, New York Times Magazine, and about the grief that, in a way, she saw this in a tradition where grief, or as she put it, destruction of the home front, sets somebody free. And she put you in a line of descent, which included Huck Finn on his raft, Dorothy in Oz, Mowgli in the jungle, Bambi in the forest after the mother goes down, the traumatic event, nominally tragic, she said, though clearly tragic, that frees the pilgrim. Do you see yourself in that lineage?
I didn't consciously. I mean, when she wrote that, I thought, yes, she's absolutely right. And certainly when I was writing Wild, I wasn't writing it because I thought, wow, I am so interesting I took this hike.
I'm Huck Finn.
Yeah. I mean, when you're writing, when writing is about, is not, when you write about yourself, you're not really writing about yourself. What you're trying to do is tell a story that resonates with other people. You use the self as the conduit into a universal story or universal narrative. So yes, I was absolutely conscious that I was telling a timeless tale of grief. When I wrote about my savage love and my savage grief, I knew I was writing about the way that we love our mothers. When I was on that journey walking by myself through the wilderness, I knew that I was writing a tale within a tradition of all kinds of tales where the person journeys into the darkness. Usually it's a man. Mm-hmm. So I was also aware that I was writing a kind of counter narrative about, it wasn't man versus nature, it was woman goes into the wild. And it was a literal journey, and it was also a spiritual, emotional, psychological one.
Were you setting out to liberate women with this story? Catherine Schultz says, as you pointed out yourself, this isn't the typical thing. Women in our cultural motif don't go into the woods alone, don't go out on the trail alone. Of course, you did. Many do. Was it a goal when you put the telling of the story together, not when you did it yourself, but when you told the story,
right,
that it would be a key to a kind of freeing of other women?
Not intentionally. I'm a feminist. I've been a feminist since I learned the word when I was 5 or 6. And so I think those values come out in everything I do. When you said, did you set about liberating women with this book? I set about liberating women with my life. I tried to, I mean, it's just part of my consciousness. And I'm so delighted. The film, too, has been really received as a feminist narrative.
No question about it. Everybody looks at that. You've been called a secular pilgrim, again, by Catherine, a secular priest. How do you feel about that elevation?
Oh, dear. What does a secular priest wear? That's what I want to know.
Whatever she wants.
You know, I don't know about that. It's interesting. When I started writing the Dear Sugar column, and, you know, obviously it's an advice column, but I was so surprised when people started writing about sugar and classifying me in this sort of self-help category. Because, of course, it is self-help, but I was really thinking of it as literature. I was writing essays about what it means to be human, which is my subject, which is what I write about all the time, and is what many writers write about. And so that it's been interpreted in a way that is overtly helpful to people, I think that that's where that priest thing comes in. I certainly make no claims to that, and that was never my intent. I'm flattered by it.
Though you minister to the people with your advice columns, we'll look at that, and it's great to have Dear Sugar originally, Dear Sugar Radio now. Can we just catch up with your personal life for a second? Like, we all know the early story, the tragic, the upheaval of childhood, the tragic loss of your mom when you were a senior in college.
Right.
Sort of wild years that followed of sex and drugs and
rock and roll.
Some rock and roll, yeah. Of necessity, of course. and then, how are you doing now? What's your circumstance? Are you Cheryl Strayed, the rural gentry, or what's your story now?
I have a lovely, happy, whole, full life. 9 days after I finished hiking the PCT, mm-hmm. I met the man who became my husband, Brian Lindstrom, and we've been together, you know, almost 20 years. We have 2 kids, we're 9 and 11, and I am just like, you know, I've spent all of these years between the hike and now writing books and writing essays and feeding the kids and driving them to school and trying to figure out what's for dinner and really always trying to remember so many of those things that I learned on the trail.
You're in Portland?
I'm in Portland, Oregon.
And how do you spend your days?
Well, it's sort of hard to answer that because the last 3 years have been so
wild.
Out of the ordinary. Wild, yeah. I've done so much traveling and talking and, you know, I've been the ambassador for a while around the world. That's been an interesting experience to talk to so many people across cultures about this story as well. But my average day is really like that of any working writer who also happens to have young children. You know, I'm constantly trying to juggle all of the things I do. And I've given up the idea of having any balance with that. I just sort of survive each day.
Do you still vacation with Oprah? Still have Reese Witherspoon on speed dial?
Well, you know, Reese and Laura Dern.
Of course,
Dern
Oprah made,
and
your, made your book the first of Oprah Book Club 2.0, and there was a relationship there.
I've become friends with Oprah and Reese and Laura Dern, and that was really born out of this. I mean, one of the things that a book does is it gives you this immediate access to break through the small talk. Mm-hmm. So these women came to me, each of them, and immediately just like
Stick
all the readers
it.
On the street. They're like, this is why I relate to this book. This is how this book spoke to me. When Oprah called me, Wild had been out about 6 weeks, mm-hmm. and she said to me, I was so struck by this, she said to me the same things that all of the people who came to my book signing said to me. There wasn't some magical other thing that Oprah perceived about the book. She received it the way readers who love it do. And Reese, the same thing. Reese was really one of the first readers. She optioned the book before it was published.
Before it was out.
Yeah, so she was one of the first people who read the book.
Did she get it, or did you have to say, no, Reese, that's not really what I meant? Or was she right there?
She got it, and that's why I let her option it. I heard that she wanted to, and so I said, well, let's talk. And we had this really interesting hour-long conversation, and I wanted to know what she perceived of the book, what she thought of the book, and what her intentions were with the film. And she was so passionate and adamant, and she promised me. She said, I will honor this story. I'm not going to have, Fabio step in at the end and ask you to marry him. And she's like, I swear to you that this movie will end where your book does, which is a woman alone, without any money, without a man, without a home, without a job.
Without the guy 9 days later who is the husband.
Exactly. Without many of the things we associate. We're, in fact, without all of the things that we associate with success or even being okay. And yet I had that profound sense that I was okay.
A kind of wonderful open-endedness that may make it easier for other people to relate.
Right.
It's not all solved. It's not all over.
And I wanted, with Wild, what I really wanted to do was tell a true story of transformation.
Cheryl Strait is with us in the hall. This is a special version of On Point. We're talking about her work with Wild, her work with Dear Sugar, the advice column. Her fellow podcaster now, Steve Allman, says she is a woman who brings radical empathy to everything she does. We ask you your questions here in the hall and from around the country, and we have got them. We'll be right back with Cheryl Strait. Cheryl, it's great to have you here. Stand by. To those in the hall, it's so great to have you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Cheryl Strait and a live audience in Boston, and this is On Point Live. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Cheryl Strait of Wild and Dear Sugar Pain before a live audience of public radio supporters at the Paramount Theater in Boston, and this is On Point. On Point Live. It's great to have Cheryl with us. We're diving in on all kinds of fronts. Wild is the big touchstone that most people know her for, though it goes much further than that. Dear Sugar, her column for many years. Now a podcast, Dear Sugar Radio. If you haven't checked it out, you should. Let's listen back for just a second to the 2014 movie Wild, an adaptation of her memoir. Cheryl, played by Reese Witherspoon, is at the side of the road trying to hitch a ride to bypass a chunk of Pacific Crest Trail. A writer for the Hobo Times pulls over and tries to interview her on the road.
This is so cool. I mean, I've only spoken to maybe one other female hobo in 2 years.
Let me reiterate to you, I'm not a hobo. And that's probably because women can't walk out of their lives. They've got kids to take care of. They've got parents to look after.
You sound like a feminist.
I am.
That's excellent. That's fantastic. I love feminists.
Yeah, it's excellent. That's fantastic. I love feminists at the roadside. Reese Witherspoon as Cheryl Strayed in the movie version of Wild. Did it happen just like we saw it there?
Well, it's a little bit changed in the film. What Reese's reply when she says women can't walk out on their lives, it's a little different in the book. But what was interesting, so I met that guy on the side of the road, and then those of you who've read the book or seen the movie, he gives me this hobo care package and a can of beer. And as soon as he drove away, I went and sat in the ditch, essentially, the woods beyond the ditch, and drank that beer and ate the food in the hobo care package. And I wrote in my journal this exchange that we have.
Yeah, yeah.
And what was so cool is then when I went to write the book all those years later, there it was, and there was this exchange that I'd never forgotten about when I said, I'm a feminist, and he said, oh, that's so great, I love feminists. And so it was really fun. It's the craziest thing. It's really the craziest thing to see your life, or at least a part of your life, reenacted on screen by people like Reese Witherspoon.
Are you doppelgangers forever, you and Reese?
Oh, we really grew this bond. There is something really deep about somebody playing me. We spent a lot of time together before the film was shot, and I was on set a lot, and then we promoted the film together. And there's a bond that we'll always have.
What are you thinking when a guy says to you, oh gosh, that's excellent, I love feminists?
I'm thinking, hey, you want to go out?
Oh, she's a feminist.
Especially back then, before I was married. No, I think that's great. I love
good.
Men who even who identify themselves as feminists. I think men who are not threatened by women who believe in equality, I think that's a really appealing thing.
Let's talk about a more complicated present reality. I don't know if you read this essay, it got a lot of attention. Eleanor Burkett wrote in the New York Times, was it just last weekend?
Right, yeah.
And she's looking at what used to, the person who used to be Bruce Jenner, who is now Caitlyn Jenner, transgender,
right.
The whole country has watched this evolution and saying, hey, wait a minute, Eleanor Burkett is saying here, I'm not sure I'm comfortable, and some other feminists aren't either, with transgender people who used to be men now defining what it is to be a woman. And in particular, what bugged her was Bruce going right away to these beautiful gowns and this sort of physical femininity, and his character, Caitlin, her characterization that what she was so happy about now was that she could wear her fingernail polish until it chipped off.
Right.
And Eleanor's saying, wait a minute, there's so much more to being a woman than that, and I'm very wary. I mean, this is my reading anyway, Eleanor Burkett saying, of one-time men, now women, fine, great, transgender, fine, coming in and defining the gender that I've lived through as a woman all my life. What do you think of that?
I think that any social movement is always evolving, and feminism is too. You know, back in the 60s, the women's movement was saying, well, I don't know, straight women were saying, I don't know if we have room for lesbians in the movement. And I think that this conversation is what's happening now. I think, the sort of, the old guard is always threatened a bit by the redefinition of gender or social constructs that the new guard is making. And so I think, I would say in general, I support Caitlyn Jenner's right to be excited about wearing nail polish. And I think that is the point of feminism. It's not saying, okay, every woman needs to look like this or be socially constructed like this. But what we're saying is we want women to have choices to be all kinds of people, right?
But Eleanor's saying, just to pursue it a little more, she's saying, wait a minute. You grew up as Bruce. You may have been uncomfortable in your skin, but you were tall, you were strong, you were celebrated, you were recruited into college, you're an Olympic athlete, you had white male privilege, all the way through. And now, you're talking about how women, the feminine mind and the male mind are different. Larry Summers, when he was president of Harvard, got in huge trouble for that, but because you're transgender, you can do it and it's okay. Still there's that hesitation. You don't share it.
I don't share it, and I think I understand what she's saying and what she's afraid of, but I do think that it's about fear. I think all of us, every single one of us, has a story that has to do with privilege and oppression, and we all have a mix of those things. And I don't think, I haven't heard Caitlyn Jenner saying that she hasn't benefited from male privilege throughout her life.
No.
I think that Eleanor Burkett is threatened by that. But I don't see Caitlyn asserting that. And so, yeah, I didn't agree with what she wrote. I had sympathy for some of her struggles or her fears. But I think that what I'm interested in is a feminism that makes these conversations more complex rather than that we go to battle with, transgender people. The feminist movement is not an opposition to the liberation of all sorts of people.
Let's talk about, there's applause in the hall. Another kind of liberation or evolution from, in some ways I see Eat, Pray, Love, Elizabeth Gilbert's book, as a sort of weirdly somehow in the popular culture or predecessor to yours, or yours is kind of an evolution to another period, a rougher period than hers. Do you see that? She was the book for a while of self-definition, go out, find it, but it was in a different way. Yours was tougher, had more blisters, more physical suffering, certainly, and maybe a more rugged path overall. She emerged as a kind of guide to life of a certain kind. Your handle has become the messenger of self-reliance. What do you think of that curve and that evolution?
Well, I think we were inevitably compared for two reasons. One is that these were memoirs that are they sort of the story took place right after each of us got divorced. We both went on a journey, And you're right, her book was the big best-selling memoir, and then along came mine, and it was the big best-selling memoir. Mm-hmm. And I think that certainly there are those comparisons. And what we both learned from our journeys is essentially, you know, they're very similar, I think, by the end. We had to forgive ourselves for choices we've made, things we regretted. We had to go on a journey and do something hard to get to that place. And I'm just nothing but flattered to be compared to Elizabeth Gilbert, because I think she's an incredibly talented writer and a beautiful human being.
I want to begin to put our listeners' questions to you. Katie writes, after all that walking and all these years later, Katie says, I really want to know how her feet are doing.
That is the number one question, is about my feet.
Hey, we're
and I want you to know, I have all 10 of my toenails.
All right.
But it did take a few years for them to grow back, because I also, you know, I lost my two big toenails.
Yeah.
And so that was a years-long regeneration process. And just so you know, they'll come back.
Okay, you heard it
here.
So
now you know.
Good. Feet are doing all right, though. We know you still love foot rubs.
I do.
Here's another on your work as a writer. Flying Yogini asks on Twitter, I'd love to know about her daily writing routine or weekly one. How does she do it?
I am a binge writer, by which I mean I have never been somebody who writes every day, and there's nothing wrong with it. I do think different writers obviously have different ways into their work. And what I do is I tend to be a sort of obsessive and an immersive. When I have time to write, when I go in these writing jags, that's how most of Wild was written, that I would go into my office or, you know, go away for a couple of days and just write, you know, 14, 16 hours a day, and then maybe not write for a week or two, and then go back into it. That's the way I write. And that's not so compatible with motherhood. And so
where's
I've had
mom?
To,
we don't
yeah.
know. She's off.
So I've had to adjust. I mean, I do have to sometimes say, okay, the kids are at school, and I'm going to write for 3 or 4 hours. But my preference is to binge write.
But you're not every day at 6 a.m. I write
no.
for 3 hours, then I have a swim and do my yoga.
No, I'm not. And by saying that, I think that really works for some people. It doesn't work for me. But, you know, whenever people say to you, oh, if you're a writer, you'll be writing every day, you'll be writing 5 days a week, I say, no, that's not true. You get to define those terms for yourself as a writer.
Linda wants to know, this is from Google Forum, and thank you, Linda, and Yogini, and Katie. What effect do you think Wild has had on memoir as a genre, as it opened the door for more memoirs by women in particular?
I don't know. You know, I'd like to hope so. One of the most interesting things that happened with Wild, and one of the things I'm most grateful for, is Wild really did jump the gender divide. One of the troubles with writing being a female memoirist is a lot of readers will assume that your book is for women. They won't assume that you've written a book for humans, which is really what most writers do. It turns out women are also human. But the big surprise...
What?
the big surprise is that men are too. And so I really was adamant from the get-go that the cover would be gender neutral, that the language around the publicity and marketing would be gender neutral. And at every turn, I would tell people, like radio hosts, mm-hmm. if they would say, oh, you've written a book for women, I'd say, no, I didn't. I wrote a book for people.
You know, I didn't say that.
I know you didn't say it. I'm not accusing you. But what's cool about that is it worked, yeah. is that yeah. then suddenly I did start to receive, you know, emails from men and men talking to me about my book. And so I do hope that Wild opened the door for other women writers in that regard.
What opened the door for you to become an advice columnist? I mean, I know literally it was Steve Almond.
Steve Almond, my hero.
He was at Rumpus. He was doing Dear Sugar. You wrote, or he you got on his screen. He said, she's the one, asked if you would do it. You came in and did it. Went crazy. He writes in your book, I love this book, Tiny Beautiful
Thank
Things.
You.
It's a collection of columns from there. But Steve writes very beautifully. Boy, everybody should want him to write their introduction.
He's amazing.
He is amazing. But he writes about, was it the first letter that you responded to where a young man just writes, WTF, 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 I'm asking this question that applies to everything every day. And you just sort of pour him some greater access to the world.
That's right. It wasn't the first letter, but it was within the first couple of months. And I think it did signal to my readers that I was really serious about this. That I wasn't going to just be kind of glib and snarky. And
or just hold his hand and say,
right.
oh, poor boy.
Right. Well, that wasn't even
you
a question,
his
actually.
Hinder.
I mean, what kind of question is WTF?
It's not much.
What's he even talking about?
Yeah, and this was your self-reliance theme, like get up, stand up.
That's right.
Fight for it.
It's what we can't even say on the radio. That's the point of the piece, yeah.
And with that kind of radical empathy, I think that's Steve Allman's phrase.
It is.
I think it describes you very well. Now you're doing it in a podcast. That's interesting. I've got a little clip from one of those here. This is the second episode of WVUR's Dear Sugar podcast. Cheryl Strayed and Steve Allman talk about the public self and the story of who we really are inside, the private self. Here's an answer to a piece of an answer to a letter from Wounded Feminist, who describes her struggle to reconcile an emotionally abusive boyfriend obsessed with her appearance with her own feminism. Cheryl talks with Steve Allman about her decision to wear high heels on the red carpet at the premiere of Wild.
As somebody who's just written a book about how powerful it was for me to walk 1,100 miles on my own.
Yeah.
I think it's powerful to refuse to wear shoes that you can't walk a mile in, you know? But I've worn those shoes.
I know, but I was like waiting for the moment that you just rock the red carpet in like beat up hiking boots.
You do.
And like, I mean, the tough thing is it's easy for a dude, it's easy for a man to say like, hey, you know, quit worrying about it, man. You're sexy how you are.
Steve Allman and Cheryl Strayed in their podcast version of Dear Sugar. What's it like to do it in a podcast instead of writing it? Does your mind work the same way if you're binge writing or if you're binge podcasting?
It's entirely different. There's almost nothing the same because, of course, those columns that I wrote that are in Tiny Beautiful Things, those are crafted essays. Those are literary experiences when you're reading them. And a conversation is a totally different thing. Most of the time, I don't go in fact, I would say all the time, I don't go in knowing what I'm going to say to Steve. And of course, what I say to Steve is in relation to what he says to me.
Of course.
And so it is a conversation. It's on the fly. I don't always say the exact right thing. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes I'll go home and go, oh, why didn't I say this?
If only.
Right. Whereas with these columns, I got to go back and then revise and change that sentence and say this better. But it's really a fun thing. I mean, that's why I did it. That's the first time that Steve Allman asked me to write the column. I did it because I thought, I've never done that before. Let's give it a try. The second time Steve Allman asked me to do something, it was to co-host this podcast, and I said yes.
Then in print, now in podcast, where do you get the chutzpah to do it, to sort of unload on people and try and set them on a good path?
Well, I proceed always from the notion that I am not the boss of anyone. I am not wiser than anyone. I do not have the answers. But one thing I do have is a really hungry, avid, searching, seeking mind. And I always want to know what's the truer thing. Like, what is the truth that sits beneath the truth that you're willing to tell yourself, that you're aware of? And I'm always trying to press into that, to illuminate the question, make it wider, broader than maybe even sometimes the letter writer knows it is.
Was the disarray of your young life important to going for the truer thing? Now that you've got kids and a happy marriage and all the rest, do you still have the drive to go for the truer thing?
Absolutely. I think more than ever. I mean, if my adult life were chaotic and sad and, you know, full of darkness, I don't think I would be able to push for that kind of illumination. I think that I learned from some very painful and hard things. I think suffering teaches us a lot. And I'm not saying I don't suffer in my life now. I do, of course. But not in some of those big ways that I have in the past. And who knows what's in the future, right? I mean, life gives us a lot of things that we didn't expect. And so I do think, though, that I make art from strength and from calm and from a sense of gratitude in my life, not from a sense of chaos and pain.
Though we remember the rampant sex and heroin and all the rest.
Right.
I guess the art came later. Question from the hall here. Cheryl Strayed, heart or head, what leads you?
Both. I mean, I think most people assume that my answer is going to be heart.
We just heard you say mine.
One of the things that has really saved me throughout my life is reason. I mean, when I was in the depths of that promiscuity and the heroin and everything, it was my mind that saved me because I realized over and over again, this can't be my life. I can't ruin my life.
What do you trust more, your mind or your heart?
My heart, in the end.
Somewhere between heart and head, We get Cheryl straight.
But there's a big cord between the two.
Yes.
In all of us. If we listen to our hearts, it's our mind is connected to it, right?
I say amen to that. Let the connection be strong. Let both be free. Cheryl Strait is in the hall with us tonight, author of Wild and Tiny Beautiful Things. She podcasts Dear Sugar from WBUR Boston with Steve Allman. It's so great to have you right here. A lot of questions from our audience will come right to them. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Cheryl Strait in a live audience in Boston, and this is On Point Live. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Cheryl Strait of Wild and Dear Sugar Pain before a live audience of public radio supporters at the Paramount Theater in Boston, and this is On Point Live. Let's get just a little bit more, Cheryl, from that 2014 movie, of course, the big movie off of a very big book that people are still talking about, people still reading, people still planning their own hikes after, adaptation of Cheryl Strait's memoir, Wild. Cheryl's mom, in the movie played by Laura Dern, is in the kitchen making dinner when she gives Cheryl a life lesson.
Cheryl, if there's one thing I could teach you, it's how to find your best self. And when you do, how to hold on to it for dear life.
And this is your best self.
I'm trying. Do I regret marrying an abusive alcoholic? No, not for one second, because I got you. See how it works? It isn't easy.
And there's going to be a lot worse days than this, honey. You can let them kill you. But I don't know. I want to live.
Laura Dern playing Cheryl's mom, Bobby, there in the Wild. Incredible scenes.
It is. I just got tears in my eyes listening to it. It's so meaningful to me, that scene. The way that Laura Dern captures the essence of my mom. Laura could not be more physically different. You know, she's this beautiful, lanky, 6-foot-tall blonde. Yeah. My mom was 5 feet tall, a brunette. People always ask me, like, well, what would you say to your mom if you could see her one more time? It used to be, I love you. It's now, Laura Dern plays you in a movie, Mom. I mean, can you believe that? But she really, you know, we spent lots of time together talking about who my mother was. And she really captured that. Nick Hornby captured it in the script, too. Mm-hmm. That it's such an important scene because, of course, when my mom died, you know, I was young enough that I was trying to reject my mom and rolling my eyes at my mom and doing the things you do in your teens and early 20s with your parents. Mm-hmm. But what ended up being true is those things that she was always telling me that I rolled my eyes at, they became the answers to my life without her.
Can I take just a moment of personal privilege here? I don't talk much about it on the air, but my own wife died last fall.
No, I'm so sorry.
My daughter was the same age, is the same age. You were.
Right.
You lost your mom. And young people, men and women, must come to you and ask for your advice in that circumstance. I've given all I can.
Right.
But what do you tell people who take that kind of loss at that age when they're not... They're not finished.
Right.
Needing, wanting. Even though they didn't know it before, they know now.
Yeah.
A parent, and maybe for a young woman, a mother in particular. What are you saying?
Well, it is. It's a terrible age to lose your mother because you are technically an adult, but you are not a grown-up. You need your mother. And it's, you know, you have to look forward to this life of never having this essential person again. What I tell people, usually they come to me weeping, and I hold them, and I tell them that I'm sorry, and I understand their pain. And that is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And so I tell them, go find your tribe. Go find the other people who know your pain. Because one of the most painful things about that kind of suffering is always having to explain it to other people who do not understand and who often don't know what to say and are cruel in what they do say. I also...
Often inadvertently.
Inadvertently, mm-hmm. Right. There's not this... They've never been through it. And so I go find your tribe. You know, Hope Edelman wrote this wonderful book called Motherless Daughters, and it's been such a Bible to so many people who've lost their moms. And I say, you know, feel your pain and grieve your mother, and also remember that the reason you're grieving is not sadness. It's love. It's love. And that is so powerful and beautiful to me, to say, my mom has been dead for so long. My mom has been dead longer than she was alive in my life.
Yeah.
And I love her so much that I still grieve her. And when you lean into that kind of love, what you're reaching for is beauty rather than ugliness. And that has been really helpful to me in my life, to remember that, to remember that in the end, the best thing I can do to love my mother is to honor her by having a great life.
I'll take that. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Phil. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a question from the hall. It's signed from Ruby Rose Fox, who sang for us tonight, and the Gloria Steinem.
Oh, she was so beautiful.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Everyone go listen to Ruby Rose Fox and the Gloria Steinem.
Our listeners around the country and the world will hear a little bit of her before their hour of this is over. A question, just make it back to your mother. What has contributed to the clarity, strength, and health of your artistic voice?
What has contributed to it? Wow, that's a big question. So many things. I think it starts with, you know, the fact that my mother loved me so well that I decided to have that good life.
But it wasn't a perfect childhood.
It was not a perfect childhood, but I did always have a mother who loved me and who was good.
That's
I think
huge.
That made all that's the difference
huge.
In the world. Mm-hmm. And it really was the thing that allowed me to save myself in the end. And then after that, you know, so many wonderful people who've loved me, my husband foremost, my friends, you know, my children, who really gave back so much to me when, you know, the thing, that kind of love that I thought I'd lost forever, I got back with my kids. And I think a lot of really hard work. The great thing about writing is it forces you to confront your deepest secrets and sorrows and shames and all of those things. And it's been really healing to me. I didn't write because I thought it would be therapy, but it's ended up being incredibly therapeutic.
Here's a question from another Cheryl about men. For you. It says, Cheryl, were you more scared or skeptical of men on the trail than you portrayed in the book? Given your one or two encounters, as related, I would have thought all men would have made you worry, but you didn't seem to be.
You know, I wasn't, because, and anyone who hikes long-distance trails can attest to this, is that there is such a wonderfully welcoming and warm and respectful spirit out there on the trail. You meet good people, and you meet people who are good across all kinds of divides, you know, because you're both out there doing this thing together. It's hard to do it, and there's a wonderful sort of kindred spirit feeling out there on the trail. So I wasn't afraid. I didn't have reason to be afraid of most of the men I met.
When you got divorced earlier on, you changed your name from Nyland?
Nyland.
Nyland to Strayed. Straayed, as in
straight
off the trail. Here's a cheeky question from the guy in the audience. Michael, now that you're in a committed relationship, would you consider changing your name again to Cheryl Hinkle?
Never. Never in a million years. Because I don't see Strayed as negative. I don't see it as, you know, doing the wrong thing or going yeah. I really, the definition of the word, the parts of the definition that really speak to me have to do with forging your own path and walking, you know, in a sort of unexpected direction. And astray is somebody without a mother and a father who carries her home on her back. And that is what I was doing, you know, on the hike. And it's what I've done all my life, you know. And I do think that was a positive word to me, not one that speaks to any bad direction I went in.
Can we get more directly political, cultural for a minute? Michelle asks, how do you now, today, as we sit here, define feminism? You call yourself a feminist. Michelle says, I feel it's become such a political term that no one knows what it is anymore.
I've always had a really simple definition of feminism, and it's, you know, it's very inclusive, because all you have to do in my mind to be a feminist is just to believe in the equal rights of men and women and the humanity of all people, regardless of gender. And it's very simple. I mean, obviously it gets more complicated as we go further down in all these different directions, but essential feminism is simply that. I mean, and historically, I mean, just the fight for women to be considered fully human, okay? Mm-hmm. First of all, the fight is still happening around the world. There are so many places where women are actually not considered fully human. And so, you know, to me, that's my definition.
How does the battle stand in the United States these days by your lights, in your lifetime? Where has it come to?
Well, I think there are so many ways that women have made great progress, and so many ways that we've actually reversed. I mean, just things like I saw like a trailer. Remember the movie Jaws? And just the women in the film, they looked like women. I mean, they looked like natural women. You know, not everyone had, you know, a boob job and a this and a that and the other thing. And, you know, I really think that when it comes to sort of personal appearance and beauty and expectations of what feminine beauty is, it's gotten so extreme.
More tightly
for women.
Defined and captive to expectations.
Exactly, more narrowly defined. Mm-hmm. And I think it's incredibly hard to be a young woman today in that regard. Absolutely.
We're coming up on a political year. Hillary Clinton's running for president. She could be the first female president. How important is that to you? Barack Obama was considered very, very important when he became president. How big a test of where the country is, or do you judge it in gender terms, or maybe in policy terms?
No, I would never vote for somebody because she's a woman. Her politics have to line up with mine. I am well left of Hillary Clinton, but if she is the nominee, I will. You know, I will be out there burning bras for her or whatever she wants me to do.
We've talked a good bit about your memoir because people talk about your memoir a lot. Aaron says to us, do people talk about men's memoirs like this? No. You can share that.
Well, there you go.
Hey.
Our work is done.
No, it's not.
People do talk about men's. I mean, I think that maybe it's just that there hasn't been one right now, you know, in the culture that's sort of been a bestseller lately, though I'm sure now we'll get all these tweets. But what about this one? But, you know, some of my favorite memoirs are by men.
Romantic love, can it sustain a relationship? Question from the audience.
Can romantic love,
as opposed to what, contractual love?
Can romance survive over many years? Absolutely. I've been with my husband for almost 20 years. I feel I still love him romantically. But, you know, there are so many things. It's work. It's work to have a long-term relationship. Yeah.
You've got the kind of followers that make people wonder about. Here's a listener who writes, hey, Cheryl Sugar, I'm wondering how you feel about the inevitability of fans, followers copying your tattoos, either from the book, Your Body, or the movie, Reese's Body. As an unfamous person with a very unique tattoo, which this listener has kindly illustrated on the back. It's three little kitty cat heads on top of an ice cream cone.
I have that on my butt, actually.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm teasing.
News you can use. It's been copied by a near stranger. I'm curious to know how you feel.
Oh, really? That's interesting. I know my tattoo has been copied, and certainly lots of tattoos from quotes. I feel just flattered about it. I understand it's weird, but, you know, tattoos are not copyrighted, and there's a reason for that I don't know what it is, but there is a reason for that. And so I think, you know, hey, you can get my tattoo if you want.
All right, we settled that. Three tattoos and an ice cream cone, three kitty cat heads. Another question from the audience. This one you're going to have to think. What's one belief you held that has changed over the years? And did you ever give advice based on that belief? If so, how would you advise differently today? That sounds like one that might take a binge of thinking to work out.
That's a hard one.
You had a belief, something that you thought was core, that was true, that was
well. You know, I
clear,
will say this.
You're not so sure.
I will say this about grief. That was really very important to me and very helpful to me. Was that when my mom first died, I thought, okay, I'm going to go through a grieving process, and it will have an order, and then there will be an end to it. And what I learned is that I had to accept that there would never be an end. And that sounds horrible, right? But it's actually incredibly liberating, because what you realize is that, you know, we can live with our suffering. And we can bear that thing that we thought we couldn't bear. And I think once I surrendered to just the simple idea that I would live the rest of my life without my mother, and even though I thought I couldn't, I was wrong, I could, then suddenly the whole world opened up before me.
Is your bigger message, your self-reliance message, somehow tied up with that?
You know, it's interesting. I don't think I have a message. It's so fascinating to me that
how it plays back.
That so much. I mean, people will say, what is the message of wealth? I just wrote a book. I wanted to write a story that was interesting and deep and real and true, and it's close.
You did it.
Thank you. And it's close to saying something universal about the human experience as possible. And the fact that people took a message from it is just delightful to me, but also puzzling. I mean, I didn't plant a message. I know I could tell you the messages that have been taken from it, but I didn't make them. I think they were, I put the story in the world and then a message was made of it.
Maybe that's the way art works.
That is the way the art works, I think.
Are you still hiking?
I'm still hiking.
You're still riding? What are you working
on? I bought a cabin on Mount Hood, and just a stone's throw from the Pacific Crest Trail. And I love to hike. I make my kids hike with me all the time. My husband and I love to hike. It's really my favorite thing to do when I have time to do things.
Toenails back and shell straight, hikes. And what about your next, I don't know, book, movie?
My
great
next,
piece of advice?
You know, my next book, movie. Well, this podcast has been an amazing thing. I have so many different projects in the works that I can't quite talk about yet. But, you know, my life, the story of my life will always be that I'm writing another book. There's always another thing in the works. That's my unbreakable thread. I've always been a writer. I've always wanted to be a writer, and that's what I'll always be doing until I have to stop writing.
Shell Strait, it's been such a pleasure and privilege to talk with you with this great crowd tonight. We wish you good luck with all of that. We'll be reading, we'll be watching, we'll be following, we'll be taking your advice. Keep it good. Keep it strong. Thanks for your advice right here tonight.
Oh, thank you.
I personally appreciate it.
This was so lovely,
Thanks
Tom.
So much
thank
for
you.
Joining us. Shell Strait with us here in the Paramount Theater in Boston with On Point Live.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Our show today was taped in front of a live audience at the Paramount Theater in Boston. Before our conversation with Cheryl Strayed, we enjoyed a live performance from edgy rock and roll vocal powerhouse Ruby Rose Fox. We'll go out with some music from that performance. Here's Ruby Rose Fox from On Point Live.
Of your own voice, raggedy, raggedy, and